The doctor heard Tragedy ask the second of its two standard questions.
Why are you doing this, Doctor?
Vonkst didn't turn back to look at the android. In front of him was an expanse of rock as large as a moon. Beyond that, the infinite ocean of black space. With one more step, Vonkst reached the asteroid's surface. He was standing on an object that was hurtling through space at an average speed of 55,923 miles per hour.
For research.
2. What Tragedy didn't understand, at least from Dr. Vonkst's perspective, was that they weren't on any normal hunk of rock soaring through the galaxy. Space was littered with meteors and asteroids. The Gordian asteroid, however, was unlike any of the other billions that were out there. Vonkst liked to provoke his boss at the Outer Rim Scientific Station, a Tractorian astronomer with an unpronounceable name, but who everyone called Dr. Phillips, by saying that there were only two types of asteroids, the Gordian asteroid and everything else. It was larger than Terst Minor and any of the other moons in the sector, big enough to have its own core and slight gravitational force. Every 75 years it completed one giant elliptical orbit around the blue sun of the McKessel system. But what made the asteroid unique wasn't its size or trajectory. It was the fact that a fleet of almost 1,000 flagships was encased within its rock. It went by many names, the Gordian asteroid, the Army in the Stone, the Excalibur. Some people called it the Red Armada because of the way exposed parts of the ships glowed during its closest orbit with the mighty star, Eta Orbitae. Parts of ships jutted out at odd angles from various chunks of the rock. There was no discernible organization to how the vessels were arranged. A pair of enormous thrusters stuck out from one area. Further down, the bow of another ship protruded from the rock. At the far edge of where Dr. Vonkst was located, he saw a line of cannons sticking out from the asteroid's surface. A fleet of ships, larger than any ruler had ever obtained, was encased in an asteroid, and everyone knew exactly where the treasure was located. Yet no one could free the ships from the stone that kept them prisoner. Ever since its discovery, one ruler after another had wanted the fleet for themselves. But one thing ensured the Armada remained elusive. Any attempt to free a vessel from the stone resulted in that ship's self-destruction, along with anyone and anything that was nearby. 3.
Doctor, are you sure this is a good idea?
Even as Tragedy asked the question, the android lifted the helmet of Vonkst's space armor over his head.
Positive.
Man and android walked to the rear of the transport, then waited as the ramp lowered to allow the doctor yet another chance to explore the asteroid. Before it was all the way down, Vonkst began across the length of plank, without stumbling or even slowing. It was amazing how confident his balance was in the advanced spacesuit. At the bottom of the ramp, he paused and turned. Tragedy was standing at the top of the ramp. Even if the android accidentally walked through the clear containment field, separating ship from space, it would be unharmed. It didn't need oxygen, and its systems were designed to be resilient to cold. It nodded, and Vonkst nodded back. The doctor knew what would happen after he began across the Gordian. Tragedy would return to the cockpit and take the transport a safe distance away from the asteroid, in case a ship detonated. A safe distance was roughly 5 miles. Everything within that blast radius would be incinerated. It was fine that Tragedy left. Vonkst wanted to be alone on the asteroid anyway, and he was aware that the android had been installed with self-preservation software. As long as it wasn't doing something to harm the doctor or the research, Tragedy was within its programming to ensure its own safety. Surely it was reasonable to want to be far away from an object that could explode at any moment. That also explained why no one else from the Outer Rim Scientific Station had volunteered to join Vonkst. He was only a couple paces across the stone terrain when he heard the android's next question come through the speaker inside his helmet.
Why are you doing this, Doctor?
Research.
4. Dr. Vongst's answer suggested something new could be discovered about the Gordian asteroid that wasn't already known. Explorers and treasure seekers had already determined that each of the enormous vessels contained within the asteroid was identical. This had been proven using mapping technology that scanned the various segments of the ships protruding from the rock, along with an analysis of scans taken through the asteroid. Each craft had 4 engine thrusters in a diamond-shaped pattern, 22 cannons on either side of its hull, and was comparable in size to the latest flagships that met in battle across the galaxy. The vessels were constructed of seamless metal that made it look as if one piece had been stretched over the entire frame. It was also apparent that the ships were constructed of a material far superior to any current technology. Humans and aliens who spent their lives on one planet liked to think of space as a void, and that as long as you had oxygen, you would be okay. The truth is, the galaxy is a harsh and unforgiving environment. There are extreme colds. Objects that orbit near a sun, like the Gordian asteroid, also face tremendous heat. That exposure to both extremes is enough for the average flagship to deteriorate, and is why fleets require all vessels to return for maintenance every 4 years. But the ships locked inside the Gordian asteroid, even though they are thousands of years old, look like they just came out of the shipyards for the first time. Nothing makes the ship's indestructible nature more obvious than the distinction between the vessels and the rock that imprisons them. The asteroid was littered with thousands of craters where meteors impacted, just as many pieces of space debris must have hit parts of vessels protruding from the rock. And yet not a single ship had a scratch on it. That question, what are the ships made of, led to dozens of other unknowns. Who built them? Why was there no other trace of that civilization left anywhere in the galaxy? How had their fleet become encased in rock? How did an ancient armada have technology that surpassed modern capabilities? Why are the ships rigged to explode if tampered with? What kind of self-defense mechanism was smart enough to remain dormant when an asteroid struck a ship, but was triggered as soon as a man-made object tried to drill a tiny hole into a vessel? They were the questions that plagued everyone who learned about the Gordian asteroid, and they were the reason Vongst walked across the uneven rock day after day. His current destination was a giant thruster jutting out from the stone. When the ship's engines were ignited, an immense amount of energy would be funneled out of this thruster, sending the ship across space. The pair of thrusters on the transport that Vongst and Tragedy had arrived on were approximately 6 feet wide and 6 feet tall. Each of the 4 thrusters at the back of the ship that Vongst approached was larger than a stadium, capable of seating 100,000 people. The sheer size of just the lone thruster protruding from rock made Vongst pause and admire the enormity of the object he was standing on. As large as the thruster was, it was but only a small piece of the ship. There were almost 1,000 other vessels all around him. There was enough rock to cover all of them. It reminded the doctor of a fact he had heard about the fleet when he was a child. A human could spend every waking moment of their life walking through the hidden armada, and not see even a tenth of the fleet. The arcing, curving metal of the thruster was within reach. It rose hundreds of feet in the air above him. From the schematics Vongst had reviewed, he knew it also dove hundreds of feet into the rock below his feet. If he tried to chisel away a piece of the metal to test its composition, the ship would explode. He knew this because it had happened to other explorers before him. It was also how he knew the nearest ship would explode if he tried to chip away a piece of the rock.
"We all die someday,"
Dr. Vongst mumbled to himself as he bent and ran a glove across the asteroid's surface. Tragedy's voice came through the speaker in his ear.
"Feeling melancholy today, Doctor."
Part of the android's responsibility on the mission was to help Vongst whenever needed. As such, it listened to everything the doctor said while out on the asteroid. All this ever did, however, was annoy Vongst, who liked to be able to talk to himself in privacy. Rather than acknowledge the question, he said,
"You might lose contact with me in a moment. Don't worry, I'm okay."
He took a deep breath, then stepped onto the section of thruster in front of him. After waiting to ensure the boots of his space armor were locked onto the surface, Vongst took another step. The clicks sounded inside his helmet, and a sensor on his visor confirmed he was attached to the metal of the ship. The suit of space armor not only allowed him to remain upright as he began up the sharp vertical slant of the thruster, it also took care of balancing him, and carrying the hundreds of pounds of protective material needed to keep him alive. Step after step, he climbed. Pausing, Vongst turned and looked back at where he had come from. There was no down, of course, not in space where gravity was non-existent. Had there been gravity, and had his boots disengaged from the ship's surface, he would have fallen to his death. Instead, he continued to climb the length of the thruster's main nose cone.
Your heart rate is elevated, Doctor. Are you okay?
I'm fine.
At the top of the enormous sheet of metal that funneled energy away from the ship's engines, Vongst leaned over the open edge. Even with the high-intensity ion light activated on his shoulder, he couldn't see the end of the inside of the thruster. Unused and dark, it looked more like an endless pit than it did a source of unknown technology.
Here goes nothing.
His hands held onto the ledge until his boots adhered to the opposite side of the thruster's cone. His suit stabilized his equilibrium. Then he began walking into the depth of darkness. 5. As soon as Vongst got back to the ship and his protective suit was off, Tragedy asked what the doctor had found at the end of the thruster's exhaust. Vongst rubbed his hands and feet. Both seemed to lose sensation when he wore space armor for too long. After a couple minutes of not having the suit's advanced breathing system, he began to cough.
Just the wall to the pressure chamber, he said, referring to the cylinder that focused a ship's energy before it passed through the slits of the thrusters. It was sealed, though.
What did you expect to find?
Vongst looked up at the android and gave a snide laugh, which only made him cough again. Tragedy, all androids for that matter, seemed to have a way of asking questions that made the logical seem absolutely absurd.
Exactly what I found.
And yet you still walked 100 yards into the thruster to make sure.
Of course.
And you'll go back out tomorrow and do the same thing again.
Vongst shook his head and sighed.
Not the same section of the same ship, but yes, I'll continue to investigate tomorrow.
There have been 2,977 organized expeditions to find ways to free the ships from the rock. All of them have failed.
I know that,
Vongst snapped. His throat burned with the urge to cough, but he managed to croak out.
Don't you think I know that?
Rather than take offense, Tragedy said,
that does not include the plethora of space pirates, treasure hunters, and warlords who also tried to free them for themselves.
It took a while for Vongst to regain his composure, for the blood to drain from his face.
So?
So, I'm curious, Doctor, why you think you will be able to do something no one else has accomplished?
What Vongst wanted to say was, you know what, you're a real asshole sometimes. He didn't, though, because Tragedy wasn't trying to be rude. It was simply trying to figure out why a scientist from a prestigious institute would risk his life when all of his associates were happy to sit in a laboratory with magnifiers and scanners. He was also tempted to ask why Tragedy was there if it was going to be a nuisance. Vongst knew, though, that the android would provide a logical answer, that the chief scientist had assigned the unit to Vongst's project. Until the doctor blew himself up or quit, Tragedy would have to be there. Instead, Vongst said,
I guess adventure, drama, and satire were already booked on other projects.
Tragedy didn't speak. Instead, its irises illuminated as it tried to assess whether the doctor was joking or being serious. Vongst helped it by offering a smile and adding,
at least they didn't give me horror.
6. When it finally arrived, sleep was fitful. Vongst knew he was dreaming because he found himself out on the Gordian asteroid's surface without a suit of space armor on. It was also easy to understand he wasn't really out in space, because two men who had died long ago were standing on either side of him. Romanov Excalibur, the man who was credited with discovering the asteroid many thousands of years earlier, and the reason many people referred to it as the Excalibur, was on one side of Vongst. Unlike the doctor, who didn't have much hair left, Excalibur had thick, blonde hair that was perfectly combed. On the doctor's other side was Gordian the Stubborn, the ruler who had spent his entire life and all of his kingdom's riches trying to find a way to procure the fleet for himself. Dark bags hung under Gordian's eyes, showing the extent of the stress he had suffered upon realizing he had lost his kingdom. For nothing.
"As soon as I saw it, I knew the ships would be trouble," Excalibur said, his voice confident, his chin slightly raised. "A couple days after my discovery, the first dimwit blew himself up trying to free one of them."
Gordian scoffed and nodded in agreement. The motion caused the loose flesh under his neck to wobble from side to side. When he spoke, the words were drenched in bitterness.
"Do you know what they called me before I became obsessed with that asteroid? Gordian the Brilliant. Gordian the freaking Brilliant. I lost thousands of workers along with much of my fleet. More importantly, though, my people lost faith in their ruler."
Dr. Vongst found himself nodding as he listened to both men. He could think of nothing, however, to add to the conversation. Romanov Excalibur ran a hand through the gold hair of his neatly trimmed beard.
"Every time someone tried to chisel away rock or drill into a ship, the same thing happened. Boom! And yet they kept showing up to try it for themselves."
He scoffed at the amount of people who had died at a place that was associated with his name. Gordian the Stubborn bit his lip to keep from letting out a string of curses. When he regained his composure, he said,
"Do you know what's left of the ships I sent here? Nothing. The explosions were so intense there isn't even a trace of my fleet. That asteroid didn't just take the ships I used to protect my people. It took my legacy."
All three men stared out at the expanse of rock that stretched so far in every direction that the ground looked flat. Here and there, parts of the ancient fleet jutted out in no discernible pattern. Vongst said,
"Don't you wonder, though, how they've been able to sustain no damage through the millennia? What material can withstand thousands of years of exposure to radiation and debris and cold?"
Excalibur sighed and shook his head.
"You're no different than all the others."
Gordian gave a scornful laugh and narrowed his eyes at the doctor.
"You think you can't lose everything the same way I did? You think you're better than me?"
"No, it's not that. I'm..."
Gordian wouldn't let him finish, though.
"It wasn't just me. Many kings and emperors spent their entire lives trying to figure out how to free the Armada. So did countless pirates and warlords."
Excalibur nodded. "And scientists." 7.
"Doctor, are you sure this is a good idea?"
Dark rings were under Vongst's eyes. After not getting much sleep, he was in no mood for the android's self-preservation spiel.
"Yes, I'm sure," he said as he coughed.
Tragedy's irises glowed a faint yellow as it processed something in the doctor's tone. It finished putting the final piece of Vongst's suit on without saying anything else. With the helmet in place, Vongst felt a stream of cool air wash over him, felt the space armor stabilize his tired and weak frame. He stood and began toward the transport's rear ramp. Tragedy followed. The familiar pair of beeps sounded, and the ramp began to lower.
"Do you mind if I ask another question, Dr. Vongst?"
Expecting to be asked the same thing as usual, Vongst said,
"For research."
"No, not that. This place has many names. Why do you refer to it as the Gordian Asteroid, instead of the Army in the Stone, the Red Armada, the Excalibur, or any of the other terms that have been applied to it?"
Vongst squinted at the android. A hand reached up to scratch his scalp, a nervous habit he had formed during his graduate studies. But with a suit of space armor on, the result was a thick gauntlet tapping against the metal of his helmet. He stared at Tragedy, and the android stared back.
"I don't know,"
Vongst finally said.
"I've never thought of that before."
8. On his next walk across the asteroid's surface, Vongst focused less on the ships extending out from the rock, and instead centered his attention on the few craters he could see from where he was standing. Each one was roughly the same size as the frame of a giant vessel, half a mile wide and 3 miles long. Each marked the place where an explorer or researcher had grown careless, or else tested another unsuccessful theory about how to breach the ship's self-destruction sensors. Each crater was initially smooth after the blast. Only after additional space debris pelted it did it begin to look like the rest of the asteroid again. Vongst marveled at the technology that had seemingly put ships into the rock without any rhyme or reason, yet had a self-destruct capability so intelligent that it never destroyed other ships encased in the rock or nearby segments of the asteroid. A previous expedition to the Gordian had focused an entire year on the results of those blasts. Of course, every possible idea, every part of the asteroid, had been dissected at length. Each organized excavation attempt and research study had taken different approaches. In an attempt to find secret doors or internal corridors buried underneath the initial layer of rock, one mission had focused on X-raying the entire asteroid. Another had sent microscopic organisms onto the stone to see if they could find a way into the ships. Sound waves, controlled explosives, all of it had been done. And none of it had succeeded in finding a means of boarding one of the ships or a way to free them from the stone. Vongst cringed. All he had was a suit of standard-issue space armor.
"And my mind," he said,
before cursing under his breath and hoping tragedy didn't bother to ask what he was talking about. He thought of Dr. Phillips again. In addition to being the lead researcher in charge at the Outer Rim Scientific Station, the worm-like alien with thousands of tiny legs was also Vongst's boss. Upon hearing Vongst's request for funding to go to the Gordian asteroid, Dr. Phillips had offered a series of gurgled noises. The sounds were translated into Basic and then spoken from a speaker hooked to Vongst's ear.
"What equipment will you be taking?"
Vongst had smiled.
"Just my mind."
Another series of noises was translated into,
"I don't understand, my dear Dr. Vongst."
Vongst had shrugged and shaken his head.
"I don't think technology will be the reason those ships are freed from the asteroid. I think whoever encased them in rock was so advanced that there's nothing I can do with a sensor or a shiny piece of equipment that will solve the Gordian puzzle."
Dr. Phillips had offered another series of gurgled noises. The computerized monotone voice had said,
"Then why are you requesting funding? What will you do?"
Vongst had closed his eyes for a moment. When he reopened them, he said,
"I just think if I can go there, I might be able to see something that someone else has missed. Maybe eyes and ears and hands are better than fancy scanners."
The pair of bulbous black eyes across from him had grown wide at the comment, and Dr. Phillips had laughed. His hundreds of tiny legs involuntarily moved in a swirl of waves. Vongst held his breath. At 17, he had solved the Arcadian riddle. 4 years later, at the university, he had found an alternate solution to the Mersiquin problem. Now, at the twilight of his career, he wanted lightning to strike for a third time. When Dr. Phillips had finished laughing, he didn't speak. Instead, he merely nodded. The smile that had crossed Vongst's face was larger than any he had offered in a long time.
"Thank you. I won't let you down."
Now that Vongst was on the asteroid, however, things were different. It was true that he possessed a brilliant mind. Age had ravaged his body, but not his brain. But he had been foolish to think he could simply observe the rocks and the ships and figure something out that no one else had managed to ascertain. He approached a large expanse of metal protruding from rock. It towered 200 feet above his head. Every part of it was smooth.
"They thought the Arcadian riddle would never be solved," he mumbled.
The metal fingers of his glove lightly ran across the ship's surface. He tapped a knuckle against it. It made no sound, not in space. But he was more concerned with how it felt.
"They said the Mersiquin problem had only one answer," he whispered.
His knuckles continued to tap the ship as he walked in a large triangle around the metal piece. Every time, it responded with the same dull thud. Tragedy's voice came over the speaker inside Vonk's helmet.
Doctor, is everything all right?
I'm fine, I'm just talking to myself.
Not that, sir. Your breathing is strained. My sensors show your heart rate is elevated beyond safe levels. I think you should return to the ship.
9. Tragedy asked how Vonkst was feeling as it unclipped the doctor's helmet and lifted it away from his head. Vonkst waved the question away, even though he had needed to sit down as soon as he reboarded the transport.
I'm fine, he said,
forcing a series of coughs to remain buried in his throat.
Just tired.
Are you sure this is a good idea, Doctor?
The android had a way of being able to ask the question without having any tone of genuine sympathy or concern. Vonkst looked down at his boots as he spoke. His voice contained a slight tremor.
Yes, I'm sure.
Tragedy reached a hand forward to begin unfastening the doctor's gauntlets, but Vonkst gave a soft push, not even strong enough to fend off a child. The android nodded and took a step back to give Vonkst more room. The doctor groaned and reached a metal glove across to his other wrist, then began unfastening the clips. After a moment, he looked up to find Tragedy staring at him, the android's eyes glowing as they assessed some kind of data.
Why are you doing this, Doctor?
The android asked in its monotone voice.
I've told you 100 times, for research.
No, not that,
Tragedy said, its irises still glowing yellow.
Why are you here, on this asteroid, instead of receiving medical care?
Any remainder of energy Vonkst possessed drained from him. If he weren't wearing his suit of space armor and its complex internal supports, he would have likely collapsed onto the bench he was sitting on.
You know?
Of course, Doctor. My job is to ensure your well-being. I received a full readout of your biostats prior to our departure. I also perform routine updates to see how the disease is spreading.
Please don't tell Dr. Phillips. He'll cancel my trip if he finds out.
Tragedy's eyes lit up for a split second, then went dull again to resemble normal human eyes.
But, Doctor, he was the one who told me.
10. The next day, rather than explore the Gordian asteroid yet again, Vonkst remained aboard the transport with Tragedy.
I don't understand,
he said, staring down at the remarkably good coffee his assistant had prepared for him.
If Dr. Phillips knew, why did he let me come here?
As far as he was aware, only Comedy, the station's medical android, had known of Vonkst's sickness, let alone how advanced it had become prior to detection. Upon being given the news, Vonkst hadn't cried. He hadn't gone and found someone he cared about and sought pity. Instead, he had leaned closer to Comedy, and whispered that he would have the android decommissioned and dropped into a black hole if it told anyone else about his diagnosis. The android's eyes had glowed a soft blue, and it had backed a safe distance away from him. The rest of that day and night, Vonkst had stayed in his living quarters and gotten roaringly drunk off synthetic whiskey. In the midst of his intoxication and prior to passing out, he had remembered the stories of the Gordian asteroid from his childhood. As soon as he woke up the next day, tired and miserably hungover, he had put in the request to go to the asteroid. Not once in the days leading up to his departure had he mentioned his sickness. Tragedy said,
"Was Dr. Phillips not supposed to approve your request?"
"No, I wanted him to. I just thought he would have tried to dissuade me if he knew I was sick."
Tragedy waited to ask his next question until Vonkst was able to contain another coughing fit.
"Would you like me to try and dissuade you, Doctor?"
Vonkst gave a half-hearted laugh and looked up at the android.
"Isn't that what you've been doing every single day when you ask why I'm doing this?"
All of the latest androids had programming advanced enough to detect and ignore rhetorical questions. Instead of answering Vonkst's inquiry, Tragedy had one of his own.
"Why are you doing this?"
The doctor sighed.
"For research."
"Forgive me if I'm mistaken, Doctor, but you were conducting different research prior to coming here, correct? What made you decide to give that up in favor of this?"
Vongst's first instinct was to snap at the android and tell it that it was welcome to leave. He knew, though, that the android didn't care where it was, and was only asking out of some need to fill a gap in its logic programming.
Curiosity.
Tragedy's eyes lit up for a moment.
You were not curious about the other research you were conducting?
Vongst slammed his mug down on the table in front of him and shouted,
Damn you! I'm going to die anyway, why not here, trying to do something important?
There were a lot of things Tragedy could have said. The android could have suggested that Dr. Vongst return home for medical treatment. It could have asked to join him on the asteroid during his next hike. Tragedy's self-preservation programming would override such a foolish notion, however, unless Vongst ordered it to accompany him. Instead of saying any of those things, Tragedy asked if Vongst was ready for supper. Vongst sighed and looked out the viewport of the transport. The Gordian asteroid was there, numerous parts of ships exposed, teasing him with what they promised.
Sure, Tragedy. That would be nice.
11. The next morning, as Vongst stepped into the boots of his space armor, Tragedy once again asked the doctor if he was sure this was a good idea. Vongst realized the android wasn't referring to walking amongst booby-trapped flagships. It was talking about doing so in the doctor's current state of declining health.
Yes, I'm sure.
Tragedy's torso pivoted to retrieve the main piece of space armor off the wall so it could be fitted around Vongst.
Did Dr. Phillips tell you not to let on that you knew about my sickness?
No, Doctor.
Then why didn't you mention it before?
The android turned its head away from what it was doing, even though it continued to fasten the internal harness around Vongst's shoulders. It never failed to unsettle the doctor when androids did things without looking at their hands.
Why didn't you mention it before, Doctor?
I didn't think Dr. Phillips knew. I wanted to keep it a secret.
I'm programmed to assist whichever scientist I'm assigned to. It was clear you did not want to acknowledge your health.
Thank you, Tragedy.
Just following my programming.
Vongst smiled as the android placed the helmet over his head. A whoosh sounded and Vongst knew his suit was pressurized.
Okay then,
he said, and stood. 12. Dr. Vongst had asked Tragedy to fly the transport to a new section of the asteroid. When he disembarked from the vessel, a different assortment of metal parts jutted out from the stone. The sight, rather than lift his spirits, only left him discouraged. In all of his excursions, not once had he found anything of note. Nothing to answer why the ships were there or how they might be freed. He had been a fool to think that simply gazing at the legendary puzzle might surpass the efforts of former rulers with their riches and extensive resources. He had investigated large swaths of the ships, the main deck, the bow, the inside of a thruster. There was only one place he could think of that he hadn't gone before, and it was where he now began to walk. The inside of one of the ship's mighty cannons. Vongst stood at the base of where a cannon jutted out from the rock and extended hundreds of feet over his head. The barrel's circumference was roughly the same size as the transport he slept in each night. The cannon would be powerful enough to destroy a mid-sized cruiser with one blast. The doctor arched a foot to allow the bottom of his space armor to adhere to the perpendicular surface in front of him. The space armor did the rest, stabilizing him as his other foot stepped upon the barrel. He started walking up the length of the weapon at a 90-degree angle from where he had been standing a moment earlier. Tragedy's voice came across the speaker in his ear.
Doctor, are you sure this is a good idea?
Positive.
The android didn't say anything else, but was surely watching Vongst's progress from a feed inside the transport's cockpit. At the end of the barrel, Vongst turned and stared at where he had come from. The asteroid was hundreds of feet below him. He took a moment to appreciate the view from atop the weapon's peak. All across the landscape of rock, he could see various portions of glistening silver ships sticking out from the asteroid. In the distance, the sun glowed blue. Vongst smiled, then lifted himself over the edge of the cannon. There he began to walk down the length of the weapon again, only this time he was inside the barrel, walking toward the point where the chamber would store immense amounts of power to be channeled through the path he was currently walking. With the additional length of the cannon that was under the asteroid's surface, Vongst couldn't tell exactly how long the barrel was, or how far under the surface of the rock he would be when he got there. The only thing he knew, the only thing he cared about, was that this was his last and best chance at finding a way onto one of the ships.
Doctor, I must advise you that this seems unsafe.
Feel free to take the transport further away from the asteroid if you like.
As he continued to walk, a sensor inside his visor told him he was at the point where, if he were outside the barrel, he would be standing on the asteroid's surface. He didn't pause to appreciate the fact, only kept walking. After another 50 feet, the cannon's base came into sight. A metal cone protruded from the internal blast wall. Vongst wasn't a weapons engineer, but he knew the basics of how the cannon would work. The blast wall would open slightly. A tremendous amount of energy that was stored behind it would have a small opening from which to escape. The cone would focus the energy down the length of the cannon's barrel, which meant the blast wall he was standing in front of had to be able to move aside or open somehow. Looking at it, however, it appeared to be a single piece of metal, like every other part of the ship. He reached behind the cone, behind where he could see, and fumbled for anything to hold onto. The faceplate of his helmet was pressed against the outer edge of the cone, while his left arm blindly searched for a lever or something, anything that might force access to the weapon's inner workings. Once he was there, he was sure he could find a way to access the rest of the ship. His fingers grazed something. Was it a handle? It felt like it. There was no room, though, for him to squeeze the suit of space armor around the cone to see, and the cumbersome metal gloves didn't allow him the same sense of touch as his bare hand.
"I think I might have found something," he said.
"What is it, Doctor?"
"A way into the ship, I think. I'm not sure. I can't see it."
A moment later he added,
"I'm going to try and turn it. Are you a safe distance away?"
"I am, Doctor."
Vongst's left gauntlet encircled whatever it was that was located behind the cone. Without the suit, he might be able to squeeze in between the cone and the blast wall to see what was there. Of course, without the suit, he would die in a matter of seconds. He would also be without the strength that the space armor afforded to be able to turn the handle, if that's what it was.
"Doctor, are you sure this is a good idea?"
His hand gripped the metal cylinder.
"Would you rather I return home and sit in the medical bay for the last few months of my life?"
There was a moment of silence before Tragedy said,
"What should I tell Dr. Phillips?"
Vongst's hand froze. He stifled a cough. Ignoring Tragedy's question, he said,
"You want to know why I called it the Gordian asteroid and not the Excalibur or something else? Because it was the name my parents used for it. That's all. I'm not Gordian the Stubborn. I don't have anything to lose. Certainly not a kingdom."
He shook his head.
"Not even my health."
Surely Dr. Phillips had understood the same thing. That was why his colleague had approved the trip in Vongst's current condition.
"Why are you doing this, Doctor?"
Vongst took a deep breath. His hand gripped the rod on the other side of the metal panel. He would either disable some part of the cannon's mechanism and find a way behind the blast wall, or he would be instantly incinerated.
"To leave a legacy."
"I don't understand, Doctor. You solved the Arcadian riddle. You found an alternate solution to the Mercicuan problem."
Vongst's hand pushed and pulled lightly at the handle to see if it would begin to turn. After a moment of silence, he said,
"Do you know how long ago that was? And the only people who care are in scientific and mathematical circles."
He pulled with more strength. The metal in his grip began to bend slightly.
"You want to know why, Tragedy?"
His suit of space armor reacted to his effort by using even more artificial force to pull the metal bar. A sensor inside his visor showed that the suit was using every bit of strength at its disposal. He paused and took a deep breath. Before attempting to pull the bar further to the side, he closed his eyes.
"The chance at being remembered."
With a grunt, he yanked down hard. The piece of metal in his hand bent more, then snapped. 13. When the flash of light faded, Tragedy saw the newly formed crater. It was roughly 1 mile wide and 3 miles long, and cut a deep swath out of the rock. The rest of the asteroid was untouched. With the press of a button, the ship's sensors scanned the surface for any sign of life on the Gordian surface. Tragedy noted the results, then sent them back to Dr. Phillips. A moment later, the android set a course for the transport to return to the Outer Rim Scientific Station, alone. The Trenches of Centauri Prime by Craig Martell.
How could this suck more? Lance Corporal Riskin Devereaux thought. It's the 24th century, and here I am standing in the muck. I used to drive a hover car, for crap's sake.
Politicians, treaties, the instruments of failed diplomacy. Maybe it hadn't failed. The war was being waged with low-tech weapons, but light years from Earth, light years from the Bazarian homeworld. Neither populace had to worry about war coming to their homes. All they had to do was fight on a neutral planet, because that was what the politicians agreed to. The Marines and the warriors dug in because they had to. No one could have an advantage. Riskin was miffed yet again. At least his boots were high-tech, but the charge was running low. The indicator flashed on his wrist comp, telling him to plug in, otherwise his feet would get wet. It needed to last another 37 minutes until he got off watch. Watch. A good word for what they did. The interstellar Marines stood around with their always sparkly clean slug throwers and watched to see if any Bazarian raised its ugly spiked head. They used to shoot at the heads, never knowing if they hit anything. They weren't allowed smart optics or guided bullets. It was like fighting in the Stone Age of old Earth. The IMs were trained for better, and then the reality of what they were ordered to do set them back centuries.
Much suckage,
Aktul whined, clicking and whistling his dismay. He stood alone at his post in the trench. The humans were right over there. If they could only lob a low-yield nuke from their mortars, this would be over and they could go home. But no, the Council of Advisors had different ideas. One destroyed planet and the weasel heads decided to talk, which meant the grunts were thrown into a swamp on a backwater planet. Out of sight, out of mind.
Hate humans, he told the wall in front of him. No humans, no mud. Humans equal mud.
He chuckled, looking down at his clawed feet. They were enclosed in a flexible polymer that helped keep them dry. The boots had been see-through, but that had ended 3 milliticks after he put them on. He carried a slug thrower.
Useless, he snorted, slinging it over his back. Might as well throw rocks.
He dug into the mud until he found a stone, hefted it into his hand, corkscrewed his body and spun as he launched the rock toward the enemy trench line. Aktul had thrown it too high. It splashed down halfway there.
Hate humans, he reiterated.
Riskin saw the rock out of the corner of his eye. He ducked, then laughed as the projectile splashed into a puddle halfway between the lines.
Candy ass,
he yelled over the wall. He dug into the mud and found a small rock. He hefted it, threw it to the side, and looked for a bigger one. The next was good enough, halfway between a golf ball and tennis ball. He limbered up, windmilled his throwing arm, and then moved to the back of his narrow trench. He wound up, hopped forward 2 steps, and heaved his rock. It made it halfway.
Damn, farther than it looks.
He would have sat down, but there was no place. The officers had taken the stools away because people were sitting on them and not paying attention. That was what they'd been told. Riskin never saw anyone else, only the lieutenant, but he said the order came from headquarters. HQ, so there was nothing he could do. Easy for him to say as he took Riskin's chair away. Riskin cupped a hand to the side of his mouth and yelled,
"Suck my hairy butt cheeks, Spiker!"
Splashing footfalls signaled someone was walking in his direction.
"Did you throw something out there, Lance Corporal?"
the officer demanded.
"Not as far as you know, Your Sirness," Riskin replied.
No one wanted to be out here. Disrespect ran rampant, especially when you had a lieutenant. New lieutenants got people killed. Seasoned lieutenants were just as cynical as the troops. And then there was this butthole.
"Why are you yelling?"
The officer stomped his foot in the mud, sending splatters over both of them.
"Damn, you know they don't have ears, right?"
"Makes the corporal feel good, oh surly one,"
Riskin barked, stomping his foot as he came to attention. He found the resultant wave of sloppy, muddy water to be most gratifying as it splashed against the pants of the second lieutenant.
"You did that on purpose," the officer declared.
"Most likely your premier sirship," he replied.
"Well,"
the man sputtered.
"Don't do it again."
He stormed off before Riskin could do it again.
"That killed 2 minutes, now what?"
Riskin asked the cold mud wall staring back at him. Aktul saw the rock arc toward him and land short. By his estimate, it traveled farther than his. He dug into the mud to find another rock, but hesitated as he heard something. The Bazarian auditory glands covered the top of their head, giving them excellent hearing. He tipped his head and heard the harsh human language, one of many different ones that they used. Stupid humans couldn't even speak one language. He'd learned Chinese, as all Bazarians did, since it was tonal, like their language. But these two were speaking something different. He couldn't understand them. Maybe they were giving orders for one of the ill-conceived but aptly named human wave attacks. If he were so lucky, he'd burn up the old slug thrower then.
"Humans are stupid," he complained.
He dug in the mud for another rock. His officer found him bent over.
"What is this?"
the third-level Marpool asked.
"Looking for a rock, Master Marpool, sir,"
he said truthfully.
"To do what?"
the officer demanded.
"To heave yonder toward thy council's enemies who are mine enemies, and if I can be blunt, thine enemies too,"
Aktul answered.
"You may not be blunt, Nug,"
the officer sneered.
"Now, drop and give me 20. I saw that throw. You're getting weak, Nug. Maybe we keep you here until you strengthen up. Can't send you home looking like you've been a prisoner of war, can we?"
The third-level Marpool laughed uproariously and doubled over, whistling and clicking out of sync. Aktul worked up a snot ball and was going to hawk it, inadvertently, onto the junior officer's back, but the Bazarian stood up, composed himself, and stalked away.
"Take your 20 and stuff them in your carapace, crack dickface,"
the upstart young warrior sassed.
"I heard that, Nug,"
the Bazarian officer yelled from somewhere far away.
"I wasn't talking to you, but to those pink-skinned meatbags over yonder,"
Aktul muttered.
"Hate Marpools."
"Did you hear that?"
Riskin asked, but there wasn't anyone around. He was standing on one foot. He'd shut down one boot to save power.
"Why, yes, I thought I heard the spikeheads having a heated conversation,"
Riskin assumed a deep voice as he replied to himself. He peeked over the mud wall and searched for movement. He ducked down before he was through searching. He moved down the trench a dozen steps before popping up for a second look. He thought he saw a spiker, that is, a Bazarian head sticking up above the trench, doing the same thing he was doing.
"You ball-slapping spikehead!"
Riskin yelled. He thought he heard a sing-song reply.
"I don't speak Chinese, asswipe!"
"How dare you speak Chinese when I don't?" Riskin thought. Riskin turned his right boot's power back on. It came to life, ensuring that it would keep his foot dry. He lifted the other from the water and powered it down. He wanted enough juice in both of them to help him make it back to his bunk, where he could both plug in and unplug at the same time. 10 minutes had passed before a lazy step splashed his way.
"About time, you slimy bastard," Riskin called out.
But it wasn't the man who was supposed to relieve him from watch. It was the lieutenant.
"Sir and Dippity, would you look at that? I'm getting relieved by the brass. Nothing to see, nothing to report. It's a big, steaming pile of nothing, just like yesterday, last week, last month, and last freaking year. So, if that'll be it, I hear my rack calling.
Riskin turned his second boot on and prepared to slog through the mud and back to the cave he stayed in for his barracks.
As you were, Lance Corporal, the lieutenant barked. As I was what, leaving? Yes, I was leaving and shall continue since you were staying. I was leaving or something like that, sir, highness, sir.
Riskin stomped in a puddle, sending a wave of muddy water over the lieutenant's pants. He didn't seem to care. Usually, he would have danced out of the way or bitched up a storm about being dirty. Riskin was instantly wary.
What's wrong? Riskin asked.
The lieutenant looked at him without arrogance, almost fearful.
Human wave in 15 minutes. Every man goes, every single man. Glad I'm not one of those, sir. I must report that I've been masquerading as a man all these years. I'm not a dude,
Riskin said sincerely.
Cut the crap. You're going over that wall, just like me.
The lieutenant looked at his watch.
In 13 minutes. And you know what, smart mouth? You'll be right next to me. If the golden bullet comes our way, we're going to take it together.
Riskin was done having fun. The lieutenant was serious. He suspected the lieutenant had a sense of humor, but it was buried deeply within, and even if he did let it out, it wouldn't be in front of the lowly enlisted scum.
Make your peace, Riskin. This is the last attack. The survivors are the winners, and they go home. This war ends today, Lance Corporal, and it's up to us.
Don't you dare try to motivate me, you sumbitch. I don't want to go over that wall any more than you do. But ending the war is probably the tastiest carrot you can dangle. Damn you.
Aktul hiked another rock and then another. He wasn't getting close enough to the human trench. He leaned against the mud wall, resigned with the fact that the human trench was too far away for a hand-thrown rock. In his mind, he was engineering a trebuchet to hike a boulder across the dead land and into the enemy trench. If it weren't for the enemy, he wouldn't have to be here.
Hate humans!
The third-level Marpul strode up. He held his skinny arms behind his back as a sign of his authority.
Do you really hate humans, Nug? Want to do something about it?
Your Holiness, I am designing a trebuchet which isn't a powered weapon. We could use that to lob boulders into the enemy trench, fill it and finish them. Then we go home, eh, Supreme Creakiness?
Aktul hated his life in the trenches. He rectified himself with the fact that he'd have to prostrate himself before his father and beg forgiveness for his brash decision to join the military. He had done that out of spite. His father said he'd hate it. His father was right. But hate didn't quite capture the full magnitude of his disdain. Aktul's body language must have given him away.
Want to do something about it and start the process of leaving this planet today? Would you like that?
The crack slammies, you say? What do we have to do, dickface?
Aktul asked.
I heard that, you upstart. In 12 minutes, a Bazarian wave attack. Every swinging limb goes over the wall. We meet the humans in the middle, and the winner goes home. The war ends today, dickface,
the third-level Marpul replied.
Aren't suicide missions supposed to be volunteer only, your queasiness?
Aktul clicked, both pleased and horrified by the latest developments.
Volunteer does not have to start with the word I, dickface.
That word, I don't think it means what you think it means,
Aktul countered. The Marpul checked his wrist monitor.
10 minutes, stinkhole. Make your peace. You and me, we go over together. We survive together or we die together. Since I have no desire to die, I will need you to fight like the very fire demons of Baal Sagoth.
The Marpul thought he was encouraging, but Aktul was instantly depressed. He didn't feel like checking his slug thrower, which he'd never fired on this planet. He couldn't remember the last time he'd cleaned it. No one ever inspected them. Aktul thought about loading up on rocks. His arm felt limber, and he was sure he could hit something with a rock. Not so much with the slug thrower. Aktul started backing up slowly, looking for a place to run and hide.
Get back here, Nug! For the glory of Bazaria we meet the enemy on the field of battle. Gladiators for all Bazaar kind!
The Marpul shouted, thrusting a twig-like arm in the air with a maniacal look on his face.
Okay, crazy Marpul, whatever you've been snorting, you need to stop. There's no funking way I'm going over that wall.
Akchul thrust his chest out defiantly. The Marpul slapped his shock stick against Akchul's thigh and stabbed the button with a pointy finger. Akchul screamed as his muscles contracted violently, and the pain shot through his whole body.
Dick face!
He yelled.
We're going over that wall because you're more afraid of me than the Pinkskins. Ha!
The Marpul ended with a fanatical scream. Akchul was unimpressed.
Sir, yes, sir, I'll be behind you all the way,
the young soldier offered as a way of compromise.
At my side, Dickface. You will kill the enemies as I point them out. We will sow death and destruction like a harvester clearing a wide swath across the great plain.
Truly magnificent we will be, my lord,
Akchul quipped, unsure what he would do. Maybe it was time to make peace with his creator, because he couldn't see a way out. Lance Corporal Riskin Devereaux stood there. One boot had run out of power and the water seeped in. His discomfort seemed insignificant at that point in his life. The second boot flashed and cycled down. At least he'd have two wet feet. Balance would be restored in his life, well, at least in the arena of discomfort. The lieutenant had moved down the trench and was haranguing someone else. At least he was doing it with the level of zeal he'd shared with Riskin. Soon the two joined the lance corporal. Riskin had seen the other man before, but never talked with him. He'd made it a point not to get to know anyone. He reasoned that if he liked someone, then he might not hate this place so much, and Riskin wanted his hate to fester in the hellhole that he'd been condemned to with the other interstellar marines he was certain were in the trenches somewhere. Hate spikers, he murmured before adding, and lieutenants.
What did you say, Lance Corporal?
The lieutenant asked, trying to stand tall and look down his nose at the junior officer. The other man was only a private, probably newly arrived, Riskin thought. At least he wouldn't be stuck in the trenches for an indeterminate, interminable amount of time. Riskin had no idea how long he'd been there. Maybe he was new too and didn't realize it.
Your penultimate sirness, I said nothing offensive and hold you in the utmost of contempt,
Riskin stated firmly, nodding once with pursed lips when he finished.
Rightio then.
The lieutenant checked his watch and looked up at the sky as he counted out loud.
3 minutes,
he bellowed, making the two IMs jump.
What the hell? Didn't you ever hear of OPSEC, Operational Security, you wank spanker?
Riskin whispered, trying to get the lieutenant to stop yelling.
Didn't I tell you? They are coming out to meet us. This is a fight to the end, right out there in no man's land. Ha! Now we'll take the fight to them. If I only had my family's ceremonial sword, I'd show them a thing or two.
Like what it means to be a psychopath in a hurry to die a bazillion miles from home in a fight over nothing. Absolutely, sir. That would really show them.
Riskin shook his head, then offered his hand to his fellow Marine.
I'm Riskin. Pleased to meet you and to go out there and die with you, I guess. Because that's our orders, aren't they? Oh, sir.